Welcome to DAC Beechcroft's Lawcast. I'm Joanne Bell and I'm a Knowledge Lawyer in the Employment Pensions and Immigration team. This is the second episode of our series of four podcasts about the Employment Rights Bill. And today I'm joined by partners Anjali Sharma.
Hi Jo, nice to see you.
Hello, nice to see you. And Sarah George also.
Hi Jo, thanks for having me.
Hi, so we're going to talk about the Bill's family-friendly equality and harassment proposals. So there's actually a lot to cover in this area, but we're going to kick off by looking at flexible working first of all. And Anjali, there's been a lot of media focus over the summer on the government's promise to make flexible working a default from day one. But with the right to request flexible working already applying from day one of employment since April this year, what does the government's proposal actually involve? I'm just thinking about how the flexible working regime is actually going to differ once that new proposal is in force.
Yeah, thanks, Jo. If we just remind ourselves actually of what the current law says, it says the employees have the right to make a statutory request for flexible working from their first day in the job. So they can ask for requests for changes to the number of hours they work, their start finish times, the days that they actually work. The employer's got to deal with it, with the statutory request, in a reasonable manner. However, they can refuse the request if they've got a business reason for doing so. So if we remind ourselves what the 8 permitted business reasons are, so that's burden of additional cost, detrimental impact on performance, inability to reorganise your work amongst existing staff, you know, impact on quality, meeting customer demands, insufficient work, and potentially planned structural changes to the business. So if you are the employer, you can base your decision on those correct facts, but there's no requirement for the decision itself to be reasonable. So if we look at what the government's proposed changes are, it's that the employer will only be able to reject a flexible working request if they have a business reason for doing so. So those 8 reasons aren't going to change, but it's reasonable for them to reject that request for that business. So if I think about what that practically means for our clients, this effectively means it's going to be bit more difficult for our employer clients to reject those flexible working requests and easier for the employees to make those requests. But what we don't yet have is the level of scrutiny that we think we will apply to those decisions. Will tribunals assess whether the employee's decision was in the range of reasonable responses, or will the tribunals take a more interventionist approach and decide whether they actually think the decision was reasonable or not? But I think what we also have to remember is the penalty for non-compliance. That's going to remain capped at 8 weeks' pay, and that's going to be subject to the statutory cap of weekly pay, which is currently around £700 a week. So there's not a dramatic change, but there is actually that shift to reasonableness that employers are going to have to think about.
Yeah, that's sort of subtle shift, really. And when that change takes effect, which, as I understand, is not expected to be before 2026, there's obviously likely, as you say, likely to be some increase to the risk involved where employers reject those flexible working requests. But in terms of the process, Sarah, will the process for handling requests remain the same?
Yes, thanks, Jo. We are expecting that the process is going to look pretty similar. Although currently, where employers have to consult with the employee when they want to reject a request, the indications are that in future, employers are going to have to follow a specific process for doing that. The bill's provided for regulations to be introduced, which will set out what the consultation process will look like. Also, as Anjali's already explained, when employers reject a request, they'll have to tell the employee the business reasons for that and also explain why the decision is reasonable. So on that, the government intention is to publish a new code of practice to help employers to understand and consider the requests and also to comply with the new reasonableness test.
That sounds like that might be very useful actually for employers. So in terms of flexible working, is obviously extremely valuable for employees juggling work with family responsibilities. But another important development from a family-friendly standpoint is the proposal to provide extra protection from dismissal for new mothers. Sarah, what do we know about the proposal at this stage?
Well, the truth, Jo, is we don't know very much about it just yet. The explanatory notes say that the bill will allow the government to introduce regulations that will ban employers from dismissing pregnant women or women on maternity leave or those who are within 6 months of their return to work. There will be some exceptions in specific circumstances. What we don't have is any information on what those specific circumstances are going to be, but we assume that they'll include things like gross misconduct and possibly genuine redundancy situations, in that case subject to the priority of those individuals to have rights to be offered alternative vacancies in that case. This particular proposal could have a fairly significant impact on employers. So one reassuring point is that the government has promised that it will consult on how the enhanced protection from dismissal should operate.
Yeah. Sarah, that's a really good point, actually. I think we also have to remember, in fact, the bill also gives the government the power to introduce regulations providing additional protection for those employees who may be returning from adoption leave, from shared parental leave as well. So although the impact assessment document notes that the government will consult on whether or how those powers will be exercised, I think we're going to have to wait and see as to what that actually looks like.
Yeah, so still a bit some unknowns because obviously we're waiting for that consultation. But something we do know a bit more about is the proposal to make paternity leave and parental leave day one rights. What's on the agenda there, Sarah?
Well, that's right. Employees already have the right to maternity and adoption leave from the first day of employment, but they're only eligible for paternity leave if they have at least 6 months continuous service. And they only qualify for unpaid parental leave after a year's continuous service. So the bill proposes to remove those qualifying service requirements for both paternity and parental leave. So in future, employees will be able to take these types of leave from day one of employment.
Yeah, and let's face it, they're only going to want to do that if they know what's going to happen about their pay, aren't they? So we need to think about whether that's also changing. So at present, parental leave is unpaid. There's been no suggesting that the government's intending to make it a paid entitlement going forward. So we've got employees who take paternity leave are currently entitled to statutory paternity pay if they meet that specific eligibility criteria. What the bill doesn't include is any reference to changes in relation to paternity pay. So we just assume that the employee will still need to have that 6 months continuous service and meet those minimum earning thresholds to be eligible for it. So that's going to be consistent with the position for maternity and adoption leave, where entitlement to statutory pay also requires that 6 month service. So it might not dramatically shift, but we do have to remember that pay is also going to be an issue going forward.
Okay, so moving on to another change that's likely to be appreciated by employees, and that's bereavement leave. Sarah, what do the government's proposal for bereavement leave look like?
Well, you might be forgiven for not appreciating that at the moment, the only statutory right to time off work to allow employees time to grieve is the right to 2 weeks parental bereavement leave. So that's following the death of a child under 18 or a stillbirth. There's currently no equivalent right to time off following the death of an adult relative. That's a gap that the government's intending to address by introducing a new statutory right to bereavement leave. And some of the features that we're expecting from this new entitlement is that employees will be entitled to bereavement leave from day one of employment. Their eligibility to take the leave will be determined by reference to their relationship to the deceased, and there'll be regulations that will set out the detail of that. There'll be regulations that will also determine the length of bereavement leave and when it can be taken, although the bill's made clear that the entitlement will be to at least 1 week's leave and the period for taking it has to extend to at least 56 days following the death. The bill also states that employees are going to be entitled to leave in respect of each deceased person with whom they have a qualifying relationship, so multiple periods of leave in the event of multiple bereavements in effect. I think the real question here around this new entitlement is what impact it's likely to have on employers. And that's likely to depend upon what, if any, bereavement benefits employers currently provide, even if not statutory entitlements. Anjali, what have your clients been saying about that?
Yeah, I think you're right, Sarah. So most of the clients I've spoken to so far have been really supportive of these proposals, actually. And actually, in practice, it's not going to have that much of an impact or burden on them. The statutory right will be to unpaid leave. So it's not going to impose an additional financial cost other than a bit of maybe HR time management to deal with those requests. And actually allowing the employees time off to grieve is something that many employers want to actually do. And they can do that via, you know, their compassionate leave policies in any event. I think the only thing that, you know, a couple of the clients I've sort of factored in is dependent on the level of person that's going out and their resourcing. It's just making sure that they've got sufficient cover for people in place, but certainly not stopping people from taking leave.
Yeah, I agree. And in terms of all of these family friendly changes that we've been talking about, do we have a time frame yet when these are actually going to take effect for employers?
I'd love to say that we do and that we have some direction as to where this is going, but it's going to be based on consultation, further regulation. So it's going to take a little bit of time for that to sort of filter through. At the moment, we know that none of the proposed changes are actually going to come in force until 2026. So we've got a bit of time to be able to help and advise our clients as to where, you know, where they're going and where they have to get to in terms of these proposals. But what it's also worth flagging is that in the longer term, the government remains committed to a full review of their family-friendly and carer leave regime. So there might be some other proposed changes within the pipeline between now and 2026. So let's watch this space, because no doubt there will be some other things that we can start to advise our clients on, you know, going forward.
Yes. And so if we move on now then from those family-friendly proposals to sort of more broader equality related matters. The bill includes provisions that require large employers to publish action plans relating to gender equality. What details are available on this, Sarah?
Yeah, so the bill makes clear that the requirement to publish action plans is going to apply to employers with 250 or more employees. Effectively, that's those employers who are already caught by the requirements to publish annual gender pay gap reports. The new action plans, however, are going to need to address both the gender pay gap and also how employers will support employees going through the menopause. Now, the impact assessment for this particular proposal gives us a little bit more detail. It notes that action plans are going to have to be published alongside employers' gender pay gap reports. It also notes that when submitting their gender pay gap reports to the government portal, employers will have to complete a form identifying which actions from a list of recommended actions they are taking to address the gender pay gap and to support employees through the menopause. And employers will then be also encouraged to provide more detail on their own website about the actions that they've taken.
Mm-hmm. And these proposals also aren't likely to come into effect for 2026. But thinking about is there any preparatory steps employers could take now, given that there are obviously a lot already of reporting on their gender pay gap?
I think in terms of where employers are now, let's face it, the reality is they're probably well on their way to compliance with these requirements. For example, if they already publish voluntary action plans alongside their annual gender pay gap report, it's probably not too much more that they need to add, you know, once these action plans become compulsory. I think what employers are currently reporting on their gender pay gaps but don't yet need to publish is that action plan. So they might want to start to consider on this before they're actually legally required to do so. You know, as if nothing else, it demonstrates they're committed to gender equality that can just benefit their organisation. So they're improving their reputation, they're enhancing their recruitment and retention of staff. So all of these are important things for them. But similarly, in relation to menopause, many employers have, as part of their wellbeing programme, have already begun to focus on how they can support their employees going through the menopause. You know, a lot of them have created menopause policies, provided awareness, training for all their staff on how their symptoms might affect employees at work, have appointed menopause champions to provide support within the workplace. So a lot of employers are really doing good things. So the employees that haven't yet done so, I think they need to give this issue their attention now, so they're better placed to sort of hit the ground running when they need to start reporting on these activities, when the government requires them to start to publish that action plan and it takes effect.
Yeah, always good to sort of get prepared and try to be a bit ahead. And thinking about the pay gap reporting as well, didn't the government also promise to introduce mandatory ethnicity and disability pay gap reporting?
Yes, that's right, Jo. That's a commitment that's in Labour's plan to make work pay, and it was mentioned in the King's speech. However, it's due to be introduced via a separate bill and not under the Employment Rights Bill. And the lead time before it comes into force is likely to be longer. We're expecting beyond 2026 for those new reporting obligations.
Okay, so a bit later, and we're going to keep an eye out for that bill. Thank you. And there's another significant area, isn't there, that's dealt with in the bill, and that's harassment. So starting with a proposal to strengthen the obligation on employers to prevent sexual harassment of their employees. Now, we've already been doing a lot of work with clients on the introduction of the new prevent duty in relation to sexual harassment, which was introduced at the end of last month. So what's different here with these proposals?
Yeah, so as you say, Jo, we've done a lot of work with our clients already over this for the past couple of months. So since the 26th of October, so only a few weeks ago, employers have been under a duty to take reasonable steps to prevent sexual harassment of their employees. Essentially what this bill does, it takes it a bit further. The government is proposing to strengthen this duty by requiring employees to take all steps rather than just reasonable steps to prevent sexual harassment. So actually, if you remember from a good few years ago, what this does, it takes us back to the way the legislation was introduced, you know, that preventative duty in the first instance. You know, the words were that it was all was removed when it was first introduced by Parliament, went to the House of Lords. They became concerned that actually a duty to take all reasonable steps could involve a potentially infinite number of steps. And so it would be impossible to satisfy. And that's, you know, that's what's come across from our clients at the moment, and the concerns that they've raised is, what does that look like in practice?
Yeah, I mean, it's really moving that to that duty to take all reasonable steps is potentially going to be quite burdensome for employers. In relation to that, is the government proposing to do anything around this to help employers comply with that enhanced duty?
Yeah, it is. It's worth flagging that the bill is going to give the government power to make regulations and specifying the steps that should be regarded as reasonable steps for the purposes of complying with this enhanced duty. So having that list would certainly be useful to give employers an indication of what are the minimum steps that they're going to have to take in this context.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. And does the government have any other plans in relation to protecting workers from harassment?
Oh, Jo, yes, it does. So one significant proposal that's also included in the bill is to introduce an obligation to employers not to permit the harassment of their employees by a third party under the Equality Act. So if we remember, under the current law, employers are liable for harassment of their employees if that harassment is carried out by a colleague, but not if it's carried out by a third party, so, you know, a customer or a client. Although that preventative duty that we've just been talking about does require employers to take reasonable steps to prevent third-party sexual harassment. So if we look at the proposal, it's to introduce employer liability for third-party harassment. It's going to be a broad one. It won't just cover sexual harassment, but harassment related to any of the other protected characteristics covered by the existing harassment provisions of the Equality Act. So age, disability, gender reassignment, race, religion, belief, sex or sexual orientation. It's going to be an all-encompassing catch-all. So as they do in relation to harassment by colleagues, employers will have a defence to a claim of third-party harassment if they can show they took all reasonable steps to prevent that harassment from occurring. So look, in preparation for this coming into force, which again, not expected, you know, before 2026, employers will have to assess the risk of third-party harassment within their organisations and the effectiveness of any existing preventative measures they may have in place and identify any steps they need to take to prevent such harassment taking place. We've already been advising clients to do this in any event to look at areas of risk and in preparation for the introduction of that prevent duty. So this is just going to be a continuation of that process, really, as far as I can see it.
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that, Anjali. Thanks. Another point to highlight, however, is that the bill also proposes to add sexual harassment to the list of disclosures that count as protected disclosures for the purposes of whistleblowing protection. Just to explain that in a little bit more depth, the law provides protection for workers who blow the whistle as long as they do so in accordance with the legislation. So for a disclosure to qualify for protection, a worker who makes a disclosure must reasonably believe that they're acting in the public interest and that the disclosure they're making tends to show one of a number of things. Currently, that there's a criminal offence, a failure to comply with a legal obligation, a miscarriage of justice. danger to health and safety, damage to the environment, or the covering up of wrongdoing in relation to any one of those things. Sexual harassment could already be covered by the existing list of wrongdoings. For example, it could be a criminal offence, a failure to comply with a legal obligation, or a health and safety issue. However, the government now wants to provide explicitly for disclosures concerning harassment to qualify for whistleblower protection.
Okay, so what difference will that actually make practically?
Well, once the change is in force, employers will need to take additional care when dismissing or disciplining an employee who's previously raised a complaint or a grievance about sexual harassment at work. Even if the reason for dismissal or discipline is entirely unrelated, there's a risk that the employee could assert that there's a connection and seek to bring a whistleblowing claim.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Sarah and Anjali. Clearly, there's plenty of changes for employers to be getting ready for, as the points we've discussed actually only represent a fraction of the government's plans. We'll be discussing more of the bill's proposals in the third episode of this series in a couple of weeks' time. So thank you both, and thank you all for listening.
Well, thanks, Anjali.
Thanks, Jo.